The Athletic.
The Phil Hayes Show.
Hello, the Phil Hayes Show is brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. Say hi to us on Twitter, at The Phil Hayes Show. I'm Dan Moylan. With me from The Square Ball is Michael Normanson.
Hello.
And from The Athletic, it's Phil Hayes.
Hello.
You can subscribe to The Athletic right now to read everything that Phil's written and all the stuff from the Premier League and the whole world of sport. 33% off the full price of a subscription at theathletic.com/LeedsPod. Sell it to me, Phil. What's there this week?
A couple of things people might be interested in. We've written about Diego Flores, who everyone will remember kind of exited Leeds quite quietly and suddenly after promotion. From what I was told, was just in need of a rest. It's pretty hard going under Bielsa, long hours, long days. Can be stressful. And surprisingly, because they'd just been promoted, he decided he was ready for a rest. But he's popped up again on the map as manager of Godoy Cruz over in Argentina, and he's made a really good start over there. They've had two wins and a draw from his first three league games. They're into the last eight of the Copa Argentina. And actually, he's a bit of a chip off the old block. I was reading about him substituting a 20-year-old after half an hour in the second game. The 20-year-old guy called Facundo Altamira burst into tears on the bench, but it all worked out because they won the game 4-1. There's also a piece with the family of Sarah Emmett, who was the little girl who died a couple of weeks ago. She'd had a kidney transplant and she was mascot twice at the club. She was a big favourite of Calvin Phillips. Amazing story, really. She was fostered and adopted by the family. And also, when it came to a kidney donation, she found a donor, or they found a donor who basically walked in off the street and wanted to stay completely anonymous. They still don't know who he was or why he wanted to do it. They've never had any contact with him. But a really selfless story. And, you know, it's quite a lot of depressing things going on in the world at the moment. But there are some amazing people out there. Better people than me.
I read that this morning over breakfast and I wasn't ready for it either. Yeah, it's an emotional read, that one. And it's at theathletic.com/LeedsPod if you want to sign up and read that. But yeah, it's a really good one. Do check it out. Well, we said a week ago, talking about the football, I signed off the previous show by saying, hopefully we're sat here in a more positive, happier frame of mind in a week's time. Are we? We've since drawn with Newcastle on the Friday, and then we've gone to Fulham and won on penalties. Is it still a little bit nervous, in your opinion, Phil? Because you greeted me outside when we met up before we came in here, saying you were worried about West Ham, which I guess we'll get onto in due course. But aren't you happy? I feel a little bit more settled.
I just think it looks like a difficult game at the weekend again. A lot about West Ham, which I think will be a challenge. I would go as far as saying that the first half at Newcastle on Friday was as well as they've played all season. I don't think even against Everton, which was a decent performance over 90, I don't think in that performance there was as much fluent football as we saw before halftime at St James's Park. It was very much there to be won, and you know there was a lot stacked against Newcastle. The crowd there are 100% ready to blow. Protests against Steve Bruce, thoroughly sick of him. I was saying in my report afterwards, it's pretty hormonal at St James's Park. It's all kicking off. And to look at their team, there's not much to it. I mean, they had the benefit of having the best player on the pitch, who was Sam Maximan. And that was where you felt a goal or something for them was going to come from. He was the one who was causing trouble. And the mistake Leeds made in the first half was not putting enough of a leash on him. Aside from missing chances, which they should have taken, he was kind of given free rein once too often and scored. But I thought Rodrigo had a really good half. He kind of did what he needs to do in that number 10 role, which is drop deep, but also to get into pockets of space and link up going forward. And it could have been wrapped up before the second half got going. But I did feel at the end of the game that it probably was a fair result. I thought Newcastle did enough after halftime to deserve a point.
We went fairly big on Rodrigo last week, actually, talking about all this in the run-up to it, saying he needed a good game. Do you feel like over this and the Fulham game that he's stepped up a level?
It makes me wonder again whether it's horses for courses with him. Are there certain games that are going to suit him in that role, you know, against teams like Newcastle? I thought against Burnley he didn't play particularly well, but he did have some little flashes in that made a difference, particularly on the counter. Perhaps it's going to be more difficult for him against Liverpool, against Chelsea, against Manchester United, because Leeds won't have so much of the ball and won't have so much kind of territorial dominance. But it seemed to work, and you could see at Newcastle how him playing like that and the players linking up together would be pretty effective and pretty good. And it must be, that must be good for his confidence. I mean, he had a difficult evening down at Fulham in the sense that there were chances there for him which went begging. But that, I think, is what Bielsa wants from him. I think he feels that little by little he can tease that form from Rodrigo. And if he can, and if he plays like that, then he's worth a place in the team, no question.
What have we learned about Junior Firpo over the last the last week or so then? Because there seems to be a real split opinion on where he's at the minute.
Felt like Newcastle was an improvement from him, and I could see how he was integrating in the team and stuff, and then he turned up at Fulham, and I thought it was awful, if I'm perfectly honest, against Fulham. And it's not to say I think we should get rid of him. It's not to say I don't think we should have replaced Alioski, because I think there's a bit of revising of that now, of everyone going, oh, we should have got him back. At the end of last season, people wanted a different left back. And if someone said Barcelona's left back is available, people were happy about it at the time.
Jordi Alba, yes.
Yes, not that one. But I think he does need more time, but I don't know about you, Phil, but I've been quite underwhelmed so far.
I can see him getting involved going forward. I do think that when Leeds are in possession and attacking, he's starting to grasp the overlaps and the underlaps and is making an impression in that respect. Defensively, it's been a challenge for him, particularly against Salah in the Liverpool game. Speaking to people over the summer and people in Spain especially who'd seen him at Barcelona, they did give the impression that defending one-on-one was not a huge strength of his. But also, you know, the way Bielsa's team set up and the way they play, they are prone to fullbacks leaving a lot of space in behind. It's always been like that. And that's been part of the reason why Calvin Phillips has been so crucial to that team, because he is good at marshalling the space out wide. He's very good at looking for trouble coming down either flank when the fullbacks do bomb on, as they're told to. It's a little unfortunate for Firpo that he's come into a team who haven't played especially well in the first month. So he hasn't had the benefit of dropping into a side who are flowing and fluent and looking good. It feels to me that everybody so far this season, with the exception of Phillips, I would say, has been a little bit below their best. I think that the core of Bielsa's team certainly have been your Ailings, your Dallas's, and that does make a difference. That's where the strength of this team comes from, that kind of reliable, regular spine. With Firpo, you would like to think he will get better, and he was very highly rated in Spain. I think it's potentially going to be a little bit of a slow burn with him. And I think defensively he does need to improve. But going forward, I am starting to see things that I like about him.
Is that a bit of a mistake in recruitment then, if one-on-one defending is a noticeable weakness? Because we play man-to-man marking.
Well, the only thing I would say is that was the observation of people who'd watched him. I don't know what the analysis at Leeds said, and they clearly felt that he would fit in nicely. I mean, they paid a lot of attention to the left-back market in the summer. It was a priority for them. And they looked at a lot of players and evidently felt that his skill set would match up with what Bielsa likes. I mean, you do have issues at right back as well, sometimes with Ailing. It's not always the case that Ailing is 100% solid defensively, but he is extremely effective going forward at his best, and he's good enough at the back to fit in there nicely. I suspect with Firpo, it is an adaption period for him. As I say, I see a lot in him that I do like. But it's safe to say that the kind of transfer of the baton from Alioski to Firpo hasn't been entirely smooth.
And we do remind ourselves that he's not played a lot of football over the last couple of years. That's going to take time to bed in, isn't it?
It is, and you're joining a team where you almost need to have played a lot of football to be up to speed and to be able to cope with it. I mean, he talked over the summer about the fact that he'd done more analysis, he reckoned, in 2 weeks, you know, video analysis sessions in 2 weeks at Leeds than he had in all his time at Barcelona. And if you speak to people at Leeds who've spoken to him, it's pretty obvious that the training regime and the intensity of it all here is completely different and a level up, even though Barcelona are the club that they are or the club that they were before they got into this enormous crisis. So it is a culture shock, as it tends to be for most players who come in. I need to write about him soon, actually. I need to have a close look at what's been going on in these games, but 5 games into the season, plus the League Cup, but 5 league games into the season, it's a kind of small sample size to reach any firm conclusions.
And a nice penalty down at Craven Cottage. You took that really, really well, in among a lot of really nice penalties.
In among a lot of nice penalties and in among some not so nice penalties either. There were a few balls that needed fish from the Thames after that. But no, it was. I mean, funnily enough, the best of the penalties came from the two kids, Gilhard and McKinstry. McKinstry's in particular was just kind of nerves of steel rolling that into the bottom corner. Someone mentioned on Twitter afterwards the game in the Gary Monk season, the League Cup game against Norwich, where Leeds, as I recall, were down to 10 players, weren't they? And looked like they were going to lose that and lose it quite heavily and dug that out on penalties. And it was kind of good for everybody. It was a changed side and it was second string. But everybody felt the benefit of that. And I got the same sort of feeling at Fulham on Tuesday, that if you'd lost that game, you'd have said, well, it's only the League Cup. And quite honestly, if you trade defeat to Fulham for a win against West Ham this weekend, then then happily take that. But looking at the players after the game, it did feel as if that might be a little bit of a shot in the arm.
It breeds confidence, doesn't it? Winning breeds confidence. I mean, you went down to this one as well. So what did you learn? What did you pick up from being in the ground? What was the general sense around the team? And obviously the fans were brilliant.
Yeah, it was funny because we were sitting beforehand saying it's virtually empty in here with the exception of the away end. And I don't know how many people have been to Fulham since they started doing the rebuild of the stadium, but what was a really tiny stand beside the Thames is now the biggest stand in the ground. You know, it's a huge two-tiered beast that totally changes the complexion of it, and I think will allow Fulham to stay there indefinitely. But because of that, you had this huge packed away end and a lot of empty seats elsewhere. I think in the end, it was pretty much half and half split of the attendance of just over 11,000. Everybody was very into it, I felt. And the thing I always like about the League Cup is it's never got the same weight on it as league games. It's a bit more lighthearted. You can enjoy it a little bit more. The highlight for me was Charlie Creswell's performance at centre-back. A huge amount has been said about Creswell, as with a lot of under-23s. And I thought the balance of the team was right on Tuesday for the under-23s who were coming in, Somerville and Creswell, and then latterly McKinstry and Gelhard off the bench. Because I was thinking back to the League Cup tie against Hull City last season that they lost on penalties and actually played very poorly. And Bielsa picked that defensive triangle of Ollie Casey, Leif Davis and Charlie Creswell. And they were bullied quite badly by Mallet Wilkes. It was a tough evening for them. And I thought the contrast between that and Creswell at Fulham, and okay, he is a year older and he's more developed and everything else, but I think you saw the advantage there of him having Phillips next to him and other experienced players round about. He looks like he has all the modern traits of a defender who gets on the ball quite happily and spreads it about, but he's got some great old-fashioned aspects to him as well. He looks like a proper centre-back, and given that he's only 19, he could be a real prospect, him.
What do you make of Somerville so far?
I thought he did pretty well. Not maybe the same player we've seen in the under-23s where he looks to be absolutely tearing fullbacks apart every single week, but I thought he contributed enough to be a decent bench option. I think that's the thing with him. We know he's not going to be starting games when Rafinha and James and Harrison are fit, but to have him as someone to come off the bench, I think I'm more than happy with that. And it is, the age he's at, you can kind of see a development there. But I mean, to go back to Creswell, I was amazed at how good he was. I have to say, I've had high hopes for him because he's another one who looks really good in the under-23s, but absolutely blown away by him. I thought it was kind of, this is heaping a huge amount of pressure on a very young man, but like, it made me think back to Woodgate, and when you see a teenage defender doing that well and looking that calm, and there were points where he was clearly organising the defence as well, and you could see him shouting at people to push out and stuff, and I just thought to have that level of confidence at the age he's at is incredible.
Mind you, Danny Mills was saying, wasn't he, that it's a risk putting the under-23s into the first team at Leeds United because the under-23s coach has probably got different ideas and the under-23s probably play a different formation to the first team.
At Leeds?
That's Danny Mills.
That's Danny Mills.
I think Leeds have probably got the most joined up strategy between the 23s and the first team of any club going. And that's been the whole point of it, is that you can drop players into this game and they will understand the system and they'll know
and it showed.
How to play. Yeah, I mean, I interviewed Mark Jackson at the back end of last season and that was what he talked about. And interestingly, I mean, he did say, he made the point in that the jump from the 23s to Premier League football is massive. And I think he got the impression that a lot of people underestimate that. And this clamour for throw the kids in, it is a really delicate balance between using too many, using the right amount, not using enough, considering that you're investing a lot of money in academy players, that there has to be some progress and there has to be a pathway. But as I say, if you compare the whole game where it felt as if the changes were too numerous and there were too many 23s in there to Tuesday where Creswell was able to thrive. I mean, he'll be going some to be as good as Woodgate because Woodgate was a proper Rolls Royce on the ball and so good defensively. But Somerville, I felt, had a good 50 minutes, faded a little bit after that, which I think is understandable. I have to say at Newcastle, I thought in the second half, Somerville probably contributed more than Dan James. I think was a bit more effective on the ball without being hugely effective, but fitted in nicely. I think what you realise is that you see Somerville and if you've got the choice, you would much rather have Rafinha out wide. And that's why it has to be kind of softly with the under-23s and you can't go the whole hog by just launching everybody into the starting lineup on a whim. But no, I mean, I always think the 23s will cope because under Bielsa, they always have. And actually, do you know what? Going back even further than that, they usually have. The under-21s, as it was, your Byrams and Mowats in a previous life were always up to it and always good enough, because the academy always seemed to be very good at gauging who was good enough and understanding that. But no, I mean, the under-23s don't play in a different way at all.
No, that's Danny Mills.
How do we come to choose players out of the 23s to step up? Because just in the past, I know we've had Halmer played instead of Strouk for a while, even though he's a tiny bit younger, isn't he? But, and then we saw Casey was ahead of Cresswell for a while. And it seems like there are certain players that Bielsa, he doesn't obviously see fit to put them in, even though there's obviously a greater long-term potential in there. I'm just wondering if you know why he makes those decisions.
It's an ebb and flow based purely on what he sees in training. So you have this emerging talent group, which is comprised essentially of 23s and some who are a little younger as well. And from that pool, Bielsa takes the players that he rates most highly at any given time. And it is a sort of movable feast. You have periods where, for example, I wrote about McKinstry as a breakthrough star at the start of last season, because at that point, people at the academy and at the club were saying he is very, very close. You know, he's somebody who Bielsa talks about a lot, pays a lot of attention to. And in the end, it wasn't McKinstry who came through. There were others who were closer last season. And it was just because that's kind of how it goes. Sometimes you're right in line. Other times you're further down the pecking order. And obviously, there's also the consideration about what you actually need to use on the day. So Halmy played down played against Bristol City, I think was his debut, and they needed a centre-back that day in the same way that they needed Will Huffer in goal. I think it's fair to say that there are so many good under-23s that there are a lot of them in contention, and it is just basically on Bielsa's judgment who he thinks is ready.
We'll get into the weeds a little bit more about the under-23s in part two. First, let's talk about Jamie Shackleton, because some weeks back at the start of the season, we were sort of touching on the fact that he was in this no man's land almost between the 23s and the first team, and we needed to find out what he was all about this season. I thought he was excellent at Fulham, a really, really accomplished performance, taking the ball in tight areas, turning out of it, distributing the ball, spraying it around, and he played in a number of positions too.
It took 10, 15 minutes for it to sort of link up. There was a lot of space between the lines for Fulham, which they were pretty good at exploiting initially. But I agree, I thought Shackleton played really well there, and I no longer really think of him as a 23, because he's been on the first team scene for so long that you 23s now, you're thinking McCarron and McKinstry and Gelhardt and Greenwood. Shackleton seems to be a step beyond them, but a step beyond them without playing regularly. I mean, I've told this story before, I'm sure, but when I spoke to Louis Coyle at Fleetwood when he'd gone on loan, he made the point that he was early 20s, but he couldn't consider himself to be young, because there were players already in the league who were 16, 17, you know, younger than him, who were playing more often than him. And with somebody like Shackleton, he is going to have to find a niche, whether it's at Leeds or it's at somewhere else longer term, because he isn't getting many minutes, but he's good enough for minutes. And I understand why he hasn't. I mean, you know, Leeds have been very, very consistent for 3 years. And this is the conversation I always have with people when they ask, you know, why don't 23s get more minutes under Bielsa? They make a lot of debuts and they make a quite high number of appearances, but they don't amass long runs of games and they don't amass lots of minutes individually. And the answer is because the team's been so good, and you just don't chop and change a team that performs as regularly as and as well as Leeds have done under Bielsa. But I think with Shackleton, without him being an old player now, because he is still young, he needs to move into a period of his career where he is getting games pretty much every week.
Just back to the specifics of Fulham then, what was it like being in the stadium for the penalty shootout? Because I don't think I've witnessed many in my life. A lot of them have been on telly, but I know it's a very different dynamic when you're in that ground, isn't it?
Well, we wondered which end it was going to be at, because you had 5,500 at the Putney Bridge end. And given the number of people who came up and said hello during the game, there seemed to be a lot of them in the main stand as well. But you see, Fulham's a really nice club, so actually you can go there and sit in the home end and people just let you get on with it. You know, it's no problem. But the penalties were in front of the home end, as it turned out, once the coin toss was done. I love a shootout where you have multiple missed penalties and it going back and forward. They're a bit dull if they just end 4-2 with one being saved, or, you know, everybody scores and then the fifth out of five hits the post or whatever else. And it was just the drama of Forshaw having the chance to win it, you know, after everything that's gone on with him and ball going over the bar. The story of Dan James flying down a helicopter after his partner giving birth earlier in the day and sucking his thumb as his went in. But I also thought, like, Gelhardt's penalty was ridiculously good. I mean, he's definitely going to be a player, him. He just strolled up, banged it in. McKinstry as well, because you were looking at those two and thinking, please don't miss. You know, like if it's got to be somebody, at least be somebody who, you know, has been around the block a little bit. Somebody like Phillips who, you know, be able to just say, be philosophical about it and say.
Adam Forshaw knows that disappointment all too well, doesn't he?
Well, this is it. You know, a kick in the teeth, but they can take it. But yeah, I thought it was great fun in the end. And without being too melodramatic, I'd been on Monday to interview the Emmetts, you know, Sarah Emmetts' family. And down at Fulham and seeing all that going on, you did think to yourself, there are times where you do need to make yourself enjoy football a little bit more than you do. It all gets a bit serious sometimes.
That's the beauty of the League Cup, though, isn't it? That you can kind of enjoy it without too much pressure, because if you go out and you can, I don't know, you accept it, don't you? Oh, and we weren't going to win it anyway, but I'll just get into this game and enjoy it just for being a bit of football. And then obviously by the end, the penalties come around, you're absolutely completely invested in it. And it probably speaks to how damaged I am as a Leeds fan, that when they missed their first penalty, I thought, oh no, they've missed too early. Because it'll flip back the other way, because it always does in penalties.
They usually do. I mean, the implications of the league season are so big financially and everything else that you kind of have to scrutinise the games individually. And I messaged you in the second half at Newcastle and said to you, I think they're going to nick this. You know, it just felt to me like Newcastle were getting the better of it. And Leeds hadn't been perfect defensively. Every time Sam Maximin got the ball, you're thinking he's going to do something here. So you kind of have to look closely at them. I think to take the Crewe game as an example, it took a long time to get through Crewe, and Costa didn't have a great game and Rodrigo didn't have a great game. But Bamford came on and absolutely murdered them, and you just kind of went away thinking, job done. You know, you can pick that apart if you want, but quite honestly, just try and enjoy it.
And Arsenal away in the next round.
I think that's a decent draw. I think that's a winnable tie with a strong team. They seem a long, long way away from being a top Premier League side or a side that you specifically need to worry about. They can play very well on the day, and they've certainly got the beating of Leeds if they do play well. But even though we've been to Arsenal a lot of times and it might have been nice to have had a different destination, I was quite happy with that.
It's winnable, certainly. It's just a bit boring because we play Arsenal in the Cup. It feels like every year. I'm aware it's been a couple of years and then there was a gap in the middle, but it just feels like we always have to play Arsenal in the Cup one way or another. So it's fairly boring in that respect. But it's winnable, which is all you want. If we'd have drawn, like, the one you want to avoid really is Man City, because they're absolute machines in this competition, and you would kind of look at that draw and go, okay, well, that's that done with.
Proper first world problems, this, though. Yeah. I mean, when I think of the same game over and over again, I think of how many times we went to Millwall and how many times it was always Forest or Derby at Christmas or New Year. You know, it was always the City ground on Boxing Day, or so it felt. Arsenal away, I can live with that, especially if the cakes in the press room are the same as they were last time.
Nice. We are due a win there as well, it is worth saying. I mean, for all the cup games we've played against them, we've not actually managed to win any. And it was Mark Viduka scored the last time we beat Arsenal. So it's a marker of how long it has been.
The great attraction is the number of away fans we get, which is going to be at least 6,000 according to competition rules. It's 10% of capacity that you get. And you hope, you'd be optimistic that maybe they'd shove a few more our way. But you complained about it, Michael, because I said, I quite fancy that. I won't mind that. I've realised I'm at a wedding the day before. It's going to be played, so I can't go. But what did you say to me?
It's too comfortable. It's too nice. You get in there, you've got about a metre in front of you. You don't even have to stand up for people to move down the row. I mean, it's padded seats. Pathetic. It's not a football ground. Give me Burnley.
I wrote about Robbie Gotts last time we were down there, because for them, the FA Cup anyway. And it was his first game after that run of 35 appearances on the bench. So I met up with his family and spoke to them about it. And I went to meet them afterwards. And I'm pretty sure Leeds took about 9,000 that night. And so I was outside the away end just waiting for them to come out, and everybody was absolutely wasted. I think it was a Monday night, and I was just standing there thinking, the Met Police are going to have fun with this.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
The Fulham League Cup game then very much brought the kids to the front of mind. We saw Gelhardt break through. He had quite a quiet game prior to the penalty, but it was nice to see him on there. Have you ever seen a player with such expectation piled upon his shoulders already?
Not recently. There's a lot expected of him, but I don't think it's just because people have it in their heads that he could be very good. It's because he should be very good. And if you speak to people who've worked with him previously. They say exactly the same. I wrote about Gilhard and Greenwood after they both signed. They're really big friends. And on the night that Greenwood signed for Leeds, Gilhard had already joined, and his mum had set him up with some digs in Leeds. And the club arranged for Greenwood to stay in a hotel, but in the end he went and stayed with Gilhard because they have been big friends since they met in the England youth setup. Chadwick was saying you remember Chadwick from Everton, he came through very young, kind of spoken about it a little bit as, you know, sort of Wayne Rooney-esque just because of his age, although it didn't work out in the same way for him. But he knew of Rooney, and you know, he said that you do see a lot of similarities between them in their attitude and their physique as well. And Chadwick worked with him at Wigan. He's in the academy at Wigan, so he got to know Gilhard really well. And he said the issue with Gilhard, and it wasn't a problem as such, because that sounds ridiculous, but he never had any bad periods. You know, so he was never out of form. He never had any kind of real adversity. And the coaches there used to say it would almost be good if he did, so that he could go through that learning process that footballers need to go through of understanding what you do and how you get yourself out of it when you are in a bit of a rut. But it never happened to him because he was that good. And I mean, when he signed, there was a lot of competition for him. Bale ended up getting on a Zoom call with him to help kind of tip the balance in Leeds' favour. And there's always so much chat about the academy players and the under-23s. And I don't know whether it's the same everywhere, but it seems to be more intense in Leeds. They kind of focus on academy development and players coming through and really wanting to see these players play as much as they possibly can. And there has been a lot of discussion, and you tend to find that this happens more when the first team results are not great. More discussion about why aren't more 23s getting a chance? Surely some of these deserve a go if things aren't going particularly well. And therefore, the debate about a pathway, you know, is there a pathway at Leeds? And I always think the reason that you know there is a pathway, or the reason that you know that players themselves believe there's a pathway, is because of the number who are willing to come here. And if you take Lewis Bate, who came from Chelsea, Chelsea and Manchester City pay by far the highest wages to academy players. I mean, somebody said to me on Twitter, are we talking sort of kind of League 2, League 1 standard of salary? And I was saying to them, Christ, no, it's like way beyond that. You know, you have players in these academies with no first team experience who can earn 20 grand a week quite easily. Easily. Yeah, no, that's the level it's reached, because there's so much money filtering down from the top. When you think about it, it's not a surprise. It's just a hell of a lot of cash. So he was offered a new contract at Chelsea, but Billy Gilmore was there and seemed to be in front of him. And Bates' attitude was, I'd rather go to Leeds because I think I'll play at Leeds and it might take a little bit of time and I might have to be patient. And he wasn't involved on Tuesday night at Fulham. But when you see Bates joining and Gilhard and other players who would have other options and other very good options, Liverpool and Southampton were both very keen on Bates, you do realise that people within the game see this as a very, very productive environment for players who want to have a career.
They've gone about assembling, well, in a quiet way, quite an effective under-23s team. I can't think of another under-23s team in the Premier League. And obviously I'm biased and my attention is all skewed towards Leeds. But nobody's done what we've done in terms of the recruitment right across that under-23s team that I can see.
There are clubs who spend a lot at that level. You're probably just not quite as aware of it because of the fact that we're based in Leeds and we see this more closely. But I think Leeds are going as far as most others do, not necessarily with the amount of money they're paying. They've been quite strict in saying to themselves, let's not get sucked into paying 5 million plus for players who are 18 years old, 17 years old. Let's try and do, you know, your 1.2 million for Bate, your 1 million for Greenwood, that kind of deal, so that you're not, you know, you're not splashing to a ridiculous degree and not compromising yourself too much. But it's been a concerted effort and they have a budget every summer to do it. And it has to be said, you know, the whole point of this is not so much for Bielsa, but for what comes beyond Bielsa, because the four players who played at Fulham are all 19 and they're going to hit their peak if they, you know, if they do make it and if things go well, they'll hit their peak at 27, 28, 29. And I don't think anybody seriously expects that Bielsa will still be here at this point. And that's why I think the way it was done on Tuesday was sensible. You were blooding a couple, but you weren't blooding too many, and it'll be good for them. You know, it won't be detrimental. They didn't have a bad night, and it's not as if they come away thinking, I'm not really up to this or I'm not ready. I think both Creswell and Somerville can feel like they contributed well. And it is pretty intriguing to me, really. I do feel as if everything at the club is right, club stay in the Premier League and develop in the way that they want to, I think they could have some very, very good players under the surface.
Just to go back to Gelhardt's signing, you said Bielsa was actually involved in it. That's not a standard thing he does, though, is he? I know some of the bigger signings he's not spoken to at all, has he, prior to their arrival? So no, how come he would get involved in something like that?
Essentially because it's a player they really, really want. And sometimes, as with Rodrigo, for example, sometimes that has to be done. I mean, I know that we've spoken about them bidding for Conor Gallagher on loan from Chelsea. Patrick Vieira down at Palace was very, very involved in that, and I think more so than Bielsa. And I don't know if that made a difference, but you do tend to find that when clubs really, really want a player, the main men do get involved because that is often the best way of convincing them. The thing that everybody at Wigan said was that the money Leeds paid for Gelhardt, and it was less than £1 million, was an absolute steal. You know, if they hadn't been in administration and if they hadn't been exposed and vulnerable, there's just not a chance that he would have left for that sort of wage. And you do want to see him, and you do see him score those goals like he did against Liverpool last weekend, and you sort of think to yourself, got to be great to see how he copes in the Premier League. But you have to get it right as well. You do have to time it. Just to go back to what you said about, you know, the pool that they're building, they won the Premier League 2 second division last season, won it at a bit of a canter. They're fourth in Division 1 after 5 games this season. They've just trounced Liverpool away from home. As Jackson was saying to me, there is a big gulf between 23's football and the Premier League, but they look like they've got a huge amount of promise.
I was referring as well to, like, you look back at the Smith, Kewell, Woodgate era of our academy, you know, go back 20 and a bit years. It feels like at the minute we've got maybe, I don't know, half a dozen potential first teamers sat in there. So many players have come in with great reputations, and obviously we always talk up the youth prospects, but you're looking at that, you know, as well as Gelhardt, Drama and, you know, Bate, Summit, Hjelder as well, being talked up as the new Van Dijk, which is a bit of a terrifying label, I guess, for him to shoulder, isn't it? But all the same, so many look like they could, based on the reports, cut through into the first team.
Part of me does wonder if a factor in this is just that we can see them now, whereas I feel like the Kewell Woodgate team, people might have seen the odd cup game if it was played at Elland Road, but no one really got to see them week in, week out, did there? And there wasn't quite the same amount of attention because the internet was kind of a new thing, more or less, in that era, wasn't it? So you didn't have to read on a daily basis about how good these players are. Part of me does wonder if it might not come to pass that they're quite as good as that. But we've essentially recruited an entire new side, haven't we? Very few of that team seem to have actually been kind of born and bred in the Leeds Academy.
Well, the statistics tell you that not everybody is going to push through and make it. And it's important to say as well that beyond the signings, you do have people like Creswell who've been there for a while. And you should certainly never be under the impression that the academy is now doing what it hasn't done in the past. It's always been really productive. It's just that now there is far more of a coherent strategy, and it's just 10 times more professional than it used to be. People in the academy have always done great work at Leeds. They really have. But it's run now like a proper Category 1 Premier League academy. They've got the status, although they could have had the status a while back because the facilities have all been in place. And to a large degree, it does make sense. I said previously that, to take Drame as an example, the idea with Drame is that once Luke Ayling reaches the end of the road with Leeds, you potentially have a right back who can step in. And if Drame develops and becomes exceptionally good as a Premier League player, you go from somebody who cost, you know, six-figure sum to somebody who could be worth vastly more, and who, if you were trying to recruit that player of that ability at that age, would cost you a huge amount of money. This is no new thing. I mean, this is what clubs have done for a long time. That's the whole point of academy development. But I feel as if they're heightening the chances of this actually happening because some of the recruitment looks really good to me.
Yeah, like, I've seen tweets in the wake of the Liverpool game, the 4-0, about Lewis Bate, for example, saying that he pulled all the strings in that, despite obviously not taking the headlines necessarily. You know, Joffrey Gelhardt did the goals, didn't he? But people saying you can see why so many clubs were in for him. I mean, I've not seen much of Bate, to be honest. I just wonder what you'd heard and seen of him.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, that is what he does. You know, he's a ball player, and he's a very, very good one. And don't forget that Chelsea were trying to give him a new contract. You know, that was where they were at. They wanted him to stay. They didn't want him to leave. He just wasn't convinced that it wouldn't mean hitting a dead end because of Gilmore and because of Chelsea. Let's not beat around the bush. Their first team is going to have a great chance of winning the title this season. So how do you get into it full stop? But even more so, how do you get into it if you've got somebody like Gilmore who is ahead of you but is currently on loan at Norwich because he's out getting experience? So that was a big signing. And as I say, when people talk about the pathway, I always think to myself, well, if the players think there's a pathway here, then, you know, realistically, there must be. You know, they must be pretty confident about that. If Beattie had looked at Leeds and said, I'm not going to get a game there, there's no way this is going to, and I don't mean instantly, you know, because he probably won't play this season, but if further down the line, there's no prospects for me there, what's the point? What's the point? Take this new deal at Chelsea, or go to Liverpool, or go to Southampton, who were also keen. But, you know, Gelhart, Bate, big prospects who very much wanted to come.
What was the state of the academy going back to like the Chelino days, when everything was essentially cut to the bone to try and get the club in financial shape? Where were we then, and where are we now versus that?
There was ample talent in it, because the recruitment, they've got a very good recruitment guy, Terry Potter, who's been there for years, and they've always been extremely good at finding talented young kids locally. The one thing that was an issue was good kids being pilfered by other clubs. You've got Man City on the doorstep, you've got the Merseyside clubs who aren't too far away, you've got Manchester United as well. And because they were Category 2, and because the first team were in the Championship, and because there wasn't a lot of money, it was quite difficult to fend off those bids. I don't think they're anything like as vulnerable now, and they've started investing now in players in a way that they just weren't doing previously. Most of the players who were coming through, your Taylors and your Byrams and Moats, have been there for years, you know, been there from the age of eight, nine. Calvin Phillips was slightly different. He'd come through in, you know, kind of mid-teens, but he hadn't been in an academy elsewhere. You know, he was a bit of a freak of nature, really, in that sense, given the way that the modern game works. But these guys, you know, as I say, with Bate, they put 1.2 million into that, which is a lot of money for somebody who you're adding to your 23s and accepting probably won't play for the first team for a while. And little by little, the investment does build up. And I know it can be a bit frustrating if it's not working for the first team as you want it to. Even in a short period, you look at the money that's getting spent on 23s, and there can be that impulsive thought of, but don't we need first team players? You know, shouldn't this money being spent there? But I think if everything holds together, and if the strategy does go as they want it to, this could be actually a really significant period for them.
Have you got a sense about how much money they've invested in 23s over the last year or two?
Do you know, I should have thought about this before I came on, but I would think that between Bate and Greenwood, and also going back to the first summer with Radrizzani, where they did bring in a lot of under-23s, many of whom weren't good enough and have since moved on, and they accepted themselves that the kind of strategy they used at that point was correct in principle, but actually in practice didn't work. They brought in too many. The players weren't of the right standard, and that has definitely changed. It's got to fall somewhere between £5 and £10 million, I would think.
It's a lot of money.
Well, between Bate and Greenwood alone, you're probably talking two. You've got Gelhard on top of that. You've got Drammy. You've got Helder, who's coming from Celtic. It's, you know, there'd been a lot of new arrivals. And as I say, they do have a specific budget every summer. And I suspect that next summer we might see more of this again.
Is this the most exciting under-23s team we've had, do you think, since the O'Leary days?
I would say so. I mean, being able to see them is obviously a huge boost to everyone now. But yeah, it felt like before, going back to the Neil Warnock era, where he basically needed a right back, so Sam Byram ended up in the team. I think it now feels a little bit more like it did in the Wilco O'Leary days, when there was a plan for these players, whereas Warnock was quite happy to play Lee Peltier at fullback until there was a gap, and then he was like, oh well, who have you got, sort of thing. It feels now like there is an actual connection between them and a proper plan, which I think that's the exciting bit, is that you can see where people are going to fit, whereas before it was very much just throw someone in because the players we've got are kind of hopeless, which is a very different situation for a young player to go into as well. He's going into a team with some planning, as opposed to just, well, I guess Lewis Cook seems really good, let's just stick him in.
If you're talking about the years post relegation 2004, this has to be the best development side they've had front to back as a starting 11. I can't think of a time when it's ever been stronger. They have produced very, very good players, and I always go back to the kind of Moat era, and you know, the let's be honest, the best of them since relegation, which is Calvin Phillips. But as a complete unit, and you know, I was talking about the money there, I didn't mention Klassen, who came in from Vålerenga. I know he came in as, you know, second choice for the first team, but Melier's got that position nailed down, and if he doesn't get injured and if his form doesn't go haywire, then Klassen is a 23s player. You know, that's where he's going to build up his minutes this season and beyond, depending on how long Melier is here for. So it is like a complete unit, and I think you can go through that team front to back, goalkeeper to centre forward, and I guess take a view on which are ultimately going to be good enough. But I think with most of them, you can say that there's a definite chance.
We broke off there between sections to hear Bielsa's press conference. The news will be out there now about the lack of bodies for the West Ham game at the weekend. Has it dented the optimism we heard in the first two parts of the show there?
Shall we start with the bad news?
Well, I mean, everybody listening will know.
They will be aware of this, but just for anybody who isn't or has been looking through the fingers, there is no Patrick Bamford. He's injured this weekend. Diego Llorente and Robin Koch missing as well. There are still decisions to be made about Jack Harrison, who had COVID. Also, Rafinha and Luke Ayling, who injured his knee up at Newcastle last week. And obviously, Struijk is suspended last game of his three-match ban for the red card against Liverpool. So they are short, although it's fascinating the way in which none of this ever seems to stress or rattle Bielsa at all. I mean, this has been going on for years now, but he gets some horrendous injury crises or selection crises at Leeds. And I know he has a small squad, but equally there are times where there are so many players missing that even if he had quite a large squad, it would still be a hefty dent in it. His only comment was to say that the project has to prove that it can cope with these uncomfortable situations. And that was all, really. So, yeah, I think I don't think this lineup will be particularly difficult to guess at the weekend, but I don't think the bench either will be vastly stronger than it was at St James's Park, unless he gets a bit of good news on the few who are doubtful.
Well, we've been waxing lyrical about the kids there in the first couple of parts of the show, so I guess we're going to be seeing a lot of them.
The first team, as they're now called.
Yeah. Yeah, but all that's missing is Eddie Gray being in charge, isn't it? Cresswell is the interesting one. He's taken a step forward in the pecking order after Fulham.
Yeah, you'll remember at Newcastle, obviously Ayling got injured towards the end and tried to play on through the injury and couldn't. So Bielsa's move for the last few minutes was to shift Phillips back and to put Shackleton in as a defensive mid. And he said the more natural move in terms of players' actual positions would have been to replace Ayling with Cresswell, but that what happened on Friday gave you some idea of my thinking, his thinking, Bielsa's thinking, when it came to where Cresswell was in the pecking order. Fulham clearly impressed him a lot, that performance down there, and he said, you know, I need to read that message. He's taken a step forward at Fulham, and I did think that sounded like a hint that Cresswell will start on Saturday. It would seem to make sense, given that the only obvious move aside from that would be to drop Phillips back from defensive midfield and play Shackleton or another in there. And no, I can see you shaking your head, and I'm thinking not for the best, really. I think what we saw from Cresswell at Fulham was enough to make you think that he could cope with a Premier League game. Not necessarily that it would be right for him to play 20, 25 games this season, but if you need a centre-back against West Ham on Saturday afternoon, he looks like a pretty viable candidate to me.
And the big fault, I guess, if there is a fault with Bielsa's system, is that we end up with square pegs in round holes. We've seen it loads, haven't we, in the past, where Phillips does get moved to accommodate injuries and we lose so much. He is the fulcrum. He's so essential to this side. I just want to see him in that defensive midfield role.
Yeah, he was asked at one point, Bielsa, about McCarron, who's just signed a new contract with Leeds this morning. And the question was, do you see him more as a left-back or a left-winger? And he said what an increasing number of coaches or elite coaches are starting to say these days, which is, there's not really any such thing as a fullback these days and not any such thing as a winger. Both need to be both. And actually, across the pitch, I forget exactly who it was, maybe Guardiola, who said this, of wanting basically a team of 11 players in which nobody was defined as a centre-forward or nobody was defined as a central midfielder. The idea that players can evolve so much that really they can play anywhere because they know what they're supposed to be doing. There's no doubt at all, though, that when Phillips drops out of that zone, they are weaker for it. And Phillips, I think, is the one player who has been on it this season and the one player who just seems to keep getting better and better and doesn't seem to be any drop in his trajectory. I think because Cresswell did play so well at Fulham, it makes it a much easier decision. And it comes back to the discussion about the 23s, which is that when they demonstrate that they are good enough, it becomes easier to pick them. When you've got the evidence of a game like Fulham, then you can feel more confident about it. I think the problem with a lot of 23s is that from time to time, you are kind of taking a bit of a leap of faith if they haven't played much.
My big question, it's over two areas, but I guess you can answer it in one go. Is it Roberts or Rodrigo up front in this one? I'd really like to see Rodrigo, don't know about you. And then the question that follows from that is, what do we do with midfield? Who goes in there? Personally, I'd like to see Rodrigo up front and then Click and Dallas in midfield, but you know, who knows?
If I'm going on what we've seen more from Bielsa, certainly on Tuesday night down at Fulham, then my guess would be Roberts up front with Rodrigo in behind. And if it's not a long-term injury for Bamford, and I don't think it is, although clearly he's not going to be fit for this weekend, then the structure is still going to be Bamford at 9, Rodrigo at 10. And perhaps it will be in Bielsa's mind that if Rodrigo is still planned as a 10 for the longer term and going forward from here, then it's better to keep him there and to help him thrive. I'm with you. I mean, I definitely see the argument for playing him up front and getting some goals out of him. I think that would do a lot for his confidence. My money would be on Roberts up front, I think.
That feels really counterintuitive to me, but then I'm not Marcelo Bielsa. What do you think? Which way around would you put him?
I think Roberts starting up front, I can feel a tension around it already. So I would like to see Rodrigo up front with some combination of Dallas, Click, Shackleton in the midfield behind. I feel like that would probably be the way I would go with it, but we know Bielsa loves Roberts, so I fully expect him to start.
I think I'd be tempted to do that as well, to have Rodrigo up front and then to have Cleek and Dallas both in the midfield, assuming that Forshaw isn't ready for 90 or Bielsa doesn't want to throw him in. They're going to have some strength and some muscle in there. You've got a West Ham midfield with Declan Rice and Suchek, and you've got guys like Antonio up front, who is very, very good player, but can also mix it as well. It's going to be extremely physically competitive and tough. And I would think that the combination of Click and Dallas could be very helpful. But as you say, Bielsa will follow his own mind. And if it is Roberts up front and Rodrigo in behind, it won't be a surprise at all.
Because that's why we signed Rodrigo. It was to play up front. I'd really like to see him in his natural position. But I get the sense in persisting with the, I'm going to use the term experiment, but just put him up front, please.
Well, it was better at Newcastle. And you did feel that if he was playing like that, he could be a big asset in that position. But he's only going to be an asset there if he does it regularly and he does it consistently. And I suppose if you're dotting between 9 and 10, a couple of games at 9, but then back to 10, it doesn't necessarily help. I suppose the counter argument to that is that you're 5 games in and you don't have a win yet. And there is, to some degree, the need to prioritise the game that's in front of you. But Bielsa does always take a broader view of this stuff. And it's similar with the injuries. You know, it'd be very easy to panic with this number of players injured or absent or doubtful, but his attitude is just that this is why I coach the 23s in the way that I do, because everybody knows what they're doing and everybody can fall into line. I don't think he's pretending in any way that he isn't short of players, because he definitely is, but I think he feels like he can manage it.
He's not really committed on Harrison and Rafinha. Do you expect to see Harrison back? I mean, he's had COVID, but by the looks of his kind of Instagram videos and stuff, he has taken it very much in his stride. He seems to have been exercising throughout and looks like he's been on a holiday, more or less.
Well, the key thing with Harrison is that he is, with the COVID protocols, he is available at the weekend. He doesn't have to isolate beyond that game, and he will be there to be picked. Bielsa was just saying it depends on his physical condition and everything else, but Harrison always strikes me as being one of the fittest, you know, physically fittest specimens in that squad. So he, you would think, could be okay, particularly if he hasn't been symptomatic. Rafinha, much more difficult to call because he didn't give much insight into where exactly he's at. But the fact that they haven't made a decision on him must mean that Rafinha is still, to some degree, in the mix.
It doesn't feel as terrifying, the prospect of being without Rafinha, when you've got Dan James in there. If Harrison, there's a lot of ifs in this, isn't there? If Harrison can come back in.
Well, that was the point of replacing Costa, was that you get somebody else who gives you more impact and that gives you the ability to rotate or to cover properly if somebody is missing. I mean, I think had Costa still been here and they'd not signed Dan James, you would have been anxious about that. You know, Costa starting ahead of Rafinha, because it had been a long time since Costa had done anything of note. James, I think, had a good game down at Fulham. His pace is blindingly obvious. You know, he's so quick. But as you said earlier, there is end product there, I think. And I would like to think it will get better under Bielsa. So yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be massively concerned about that switch if that's what happens. But I think you would always want Rafinha to start.
So how do we hurt West Ham then, in your opinion? How can we get at them? Where can we get something out of this game?
Well, it's the same way that Leeds always hurt teams, which is making the most of the space. That's what they did very well against Newcastle, until the point where Steve Bruce pushed Hayden a little bit more onto Rodrigo and started to cut out the gaps. But work the space out wide, make the most of Harrison, make the most of Dan James or Rafinha, if it is James who plays out on the flank. It is standard Bielsa style, you know, he will do what he does. And the thing I liked about Bielsa's press conference last week, the previous one, was him basically saying, "Look, we'll tough this out by playing the way that we always do." I don't think he actually feels like the form, and he wouldn't make grand claims about the results, but I don't think he feels like the form and the performances are actually that far off. He can tell that they're not bang on either, but he still seems pretty optimistic about it all coming together pretty soon. But yeah, I mean, it's they can hurt West Ham in the way that they hurt everybody else when they're on form.
I mentioned earlier on in the show when I came in today that you said you were a little bit worried about this one, and presumably the injury state hasn't helped that. Are you worried about it? Why are you worried about it?
I think there's a lot about West Ham that doesn't really suit Leeds, the way they play. They're a good team. Bielsa was asked about them and he said they look like they're improving again this season, which I can definitely agree with. I can see that in them. They've sort of felt their way in under Moyes little by little. And, you know, as last season went on, they started to look like they properly understood what he was asking them to do. They seemed like they properly understood themselves as a team in the way that Leeds do when Leeds are playing well. They have ample quality in the team. I think it's a game Leeds can take something from. I don't look at them as an opposition side and think that they're up there with the best of the teams in the Premier League, but they are a good side. And it is the case that Leeds are not at their peak at the moment, and in terms of bodies are a long way from, you know, strongest lineup.
I feel like a reshuffled defence is probably not ideal for the set pieces either, because that's somewhere they completely had the beating of us last year. And Cresswell got one. Did Suchet get one from a corner as well last year? And it felt like every time they had one, there was a lot of danger.
And again, down there, I think it was Dawson scored in the game down in London. It hasn't felt actually like Leeds have been as vulnerable from set pieces since the second half of last season got going, you know, after Christmas. In the first half of the season in the Premier League, it was very apparent that teams were taking advantage of that. And I looked quite closely at the structure of the way Bielsa was setting them up, the man marking, and what was working in those situations, and I guess more importantly, what was going wrong. It hasn't felt like the same sort of Achilles heel, but I think it's safe to say that if there's a team who are going to do damage to you in those scenarios, West Ham are probably one of them.
They played in the League Cup the day after us, so we've had an extra day's rest. Plus, we're obviously at home on Saturday, whereas they've got to travel again. Is that going to help us a little bit, you think?
Possibly. I assume they've gone back down south, although clubs from time to time will stick it. If there isn't much of a turnaround, will occasionally. I've seen Leeds do it before when they've had two games in the south of England, stay over at a hotel somewhere and train. I'm honestly not sure what West Ham have done. They will be able to freshen up slightly. Antonio is fit, they're saying, and I would think we'll start, you would imagine. But if not, we'll be there to be used. And, I mean, the Wednesday-Saturday turnaround doesn't tend to be massively difficult for Premier League players. I think it'll be blood and thunder, this game, to be honest. I can see it being a very good one with a packed crowd.
You told me off for my optimism last week. Mm-hmm. You told me I was to predict Leeds United would lose because I was jinxing the football team. But I am going to predict a Leeds win, I have done already, just because we need one, and eventually we've got to get one. And why not this weekend? And I've got a feeling that, like, Leeds sometimes have these in us where we're being written off, the odds look like they're against us, and then we pull one out of the bag. I thought we'd win last week, but why not this week?
I think I'll feel more confident coming around to the games against Watford and Wolves and Norwich and so on. I'm going to hope that there's a point in this for Leeds. It'd be great. I honestly feel as if one win will get them going. I do feel like one win will get this season going properly. I'm not convinced it's going to come on Saturday. I think it's a difficult game with numbers a little bit short. But a point would be decent against this lot because they're good.
I feel like no Rafinha and no Bamford would be probably the end of us. I've got to be honest. I feel like that's where Rafinha, we rely heavily on him, even though I think he's not maybe quite hit his peak this season. We do still rely on him massively, don't we, to create things. So I think if he is out, that would be a fairly major blow.
We're showing the club down then. That's it, because it's over.
Yeah, I think that's probably for the best. It's just
survived admin in 2007, but Rafinha's injured. Let's wrap it up.
Yeah, I think I did predict a 1-1 draw on our podcast, but I thought Rafinha would be fit.
Is a draw a good result from this? You think so, Phil? What about you?
Yeah, I think a draw would be, given all the difficulties we've got with injuries and the suspension, I think a point is more than adequate in this, as much as it won't do a huge amount to alleviate the general tension around the place.
Phil, you've got an itch you want to scratch a little bit about stuff people have been saying to you in the last few days. You want to moan about young people, don't you?
No. I should make that clear, because they would not like me moaning about them, and they'd say, "You 40-year-old, you old sod, lighten up." I was in Wetherspoons on Wednesday after the Fulham game, just getting some breakfast, and I got chatting.
That is a Scotsmith.
Yeah, I know. $4.99, I think it was.
Mind you, what you texted me when you were at King's Cross, weren't you?
After the game, moaning about the
beer prices.
Well, needless to say, I then gravitated towards Spoons, and everything levelled itself out again. I got chatting to a guy in there, Leeds fan, and hello if you are listening, who had this conversation with me that I seem to have had with loads of people since the start of this season. And he was basically saying that he thinks that there's a big difference between the attitude of the older supporter at the moment to how it's gone this season and the younger supporter. He said he could see a real sort of reactionary attitude amongst the younger breed. And it just occurred to me that it's definitely not the first time someone said that to me this season. I can think of five or six people who've said exactly the same, that there's a little sort of undercurrent of, I guess, a lack of realism about what this season should be, how it should go, what Leeds should be aspiring for, what realistically they can achieve in the Premier League. I don't know, it's quite odd, because you do sense tension out there. But when I speak to supporters like that, they actually seem pretty content with everything. You know, they don't seem overly panicked by this. I think they almost feel like it's a kind of natural step, that getting up into the Premier League and acclimatising to it means that there are going to be periods where it doesn't go so well.
Right, so we'll call this episode Generational Divide. Make sure all the clips are you slating young people.
Do you think that's fair, though? Do you think that's...
Yes and no. I think it's influenced by social media. I think too many of us take what you see on there as the real life moods and attitudes of Leeds fans, when it's not. When actually, you know what? You get into Elland Road. We'll get into Elland Road at 3 o'clock on Saturday. The atmosphere, it'll be great, again, because this team has got the complete backing of the fans. And while there is that sort of undercurrent of tension there until we get that win under our belts, I don't think it's necessarily true. I think you've got to remember stuff like Twitter, people shooting from the hip about thoughts that pass through their mind, you know, in a fleeting second, and then it's gone again, and then you feel all right, you know, and it tends to bring out the negativity rather than the balance. I mean, because you tend not to get reaction to balance, do you? You'll pour out a negative opinion or a fear, somebody will react to it, and so the algorithm continues bumping you up.
You've also got to be careful, I think, that you assume that everybody who is being reactionary on Twitter is young. I mean, I don't think
those were your words, Phil.
Necessarily the case. Not my words, Dan, the words of five or six supporters. I don't know. I think that...
Are they just moaning old farts, Phil?
I don't know, really. That's what I'm asking
old,
you.
Old man shouts at cloud and all that?
Yeah, except the old men don't seem to be shouting at clouds, or not the ones who've been speaking to me recently. You go through a period like this and you expect that everybody will be a little bit on edge and a little bit anxious about it. And actually as I was sat speaking to him, and he was kind of saying, look, I'm all right with all this, to be honest. I think we're okay. And, you know, referencing the League One years and the kind of long run through the Championship where nothing seemed to be doing it. It just sort of occurred to me that actually, you know, not everybody is struggling with this at the moment.
I mean, I'm labelled as pessimistic, which is a fair enough point, given I just said we should shut the club down because Rafinha's not playing. But I don't really that everything is fine at the moment. Like, it's not Derby bad, is it? You know, things are... And also, when I look at the YouTube comments of our podcast, and there's people saying, we will definitely go down if we stick with Bielsa and Ayling this season. You think, well, that's not true, is it? Like, you've got to give these things a little bit of time. Like, that's obviously a ridiculous knee-jerk reaction. I think what... There's a general feeling, I think, of things not being as fun as they were last year. And I think that is fair. Like, yeah. It is fine to be like, we have taken a step back from last season, but equally, last season was far in excess of expectations, wasn't it? So last season, 17th would have been great. Everyone would have taken it. This year, people are going to go absolutely mental about finishing 17th.
I think Moscow said this, and he was right. It's almost as if the seasons have been back to front. Do you know what I mean? Like, you'd have expected your first season in the Premier League to be a bit dicey and a bit difficult, and then to kind of make progress from there. And it's almost been the other way around, because last season was so good. I honestly feel like what's happening with the team at the moment is that, with very few exceptions, and Phillips being one of them, everybody just seems to be a little bit below the peak. And Bielsa has said loads of times over the years, in order for us to play well, we have to be at 100% all the time. We can't really have any deviation from that. Otherwise, it does start to affect us. And I felt like it was coming a little bit at Newcastle. I did feel like the first half, as I said earlier, was the best they've played in the Premier League this season. it does need to come together more. It doesn't help that they are without the number of players that they're without. But it doesn't feel like anything like crisis mode to me either.
That Newcastle game, I think if we go two up in that, that kickstarts the season and we would have run away with that game. No two ways about it. 1-0 is always a dangerous score, as they say, isn't it? But, or is it 2-0 that's the dangerous score? Either way, but if we'd have got two goals in front in that first half, I think it would have given us a huge amount of confidence, and football turns on moments. And
more to the point, I mean, the crowd were just looking for the invitation.
They were waiting for it, yeah.
To lynch Bruce. But as always happens, even a really volatile and mutinous crowd get engaged in a game which they suddenly think they might win. And that was, once Saint-Maximin scored, that was what changed. It wasn't like there were no chance against Bruce after that, but suddenly the whole of St. James's Park started to think, we might actually win this. And so their attention sort of drifted a bit from Bruce and everything else, and they got more engaged in the football itself. I'm with you. I mean, I was sat with Chris Warfield, one of our Newcastle writers, and we both said, if Leeds score again here, this is all over. You know, Newcastle will fall apart. And really, in the end, they relied on, you know, the one player who was going to dig them out of trouble. I think that is one of the big differences to look at Newcastle and look at Leeds. It's not solely reliant on one person here at all. I know Phillips is such a focal point in the team, but when everybody plays well, there are players other than him who do make a huge impact. It felt a little bit at St. Well, not even a little bit. It felt at St. James's Park like it was Bruce out and Saint-Maximin or bust.
I think a good test of this, maybe the litmus test, is, are you looking forward to going on Saturday? And overwhelmingly, yes.
Yeah.
Is the answer to it. I can't wait to get back in there, because this is great. I've waited for so long to see Leeds in the Premier League.
Yeah, which you don't get the feeling is the case at St James's, dear. People will be like, oh, I've got my season ticket. And I remember those days.
My mates text me and say, there's such a malaise there. They're not bothered. The football is the worst part of it.
I remember the days at Leeds where you'd go to games, you'd be like, oh, God, there's another one on Tuesday as well. And you'd have that feeling of like, well, what else am I going to do? I suppose I'll go, but I'm not expecting anything.
I'm still going by train at the minute, so I was up there fairly early on Friday, and I sat on a wall outside just fiddling on my phone just down the road from the Strawberry, and these two Newcastle fans walked past me, and one of them did say to the other one, I don't know why we're fucking bothering. I mean, you sort of had to laugh, but then part of you thought, imagine that, you know.
But we've been there.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're right. But you forget really quickly, don't you? You forget really quickly when things turn around and things become good. But that is how it is. There seems to be, it's not even like approaching the stadium with dread. It's just a complete vacuum of, not a vacuum of emotion, because people are very, very angry up there, but it's a total vacuum of ambition. And looking forward to West Ham at home, absolutely. Yeah.
I think if they switched off social media, that'd probably help everyone quite a great deal. And with that in mind, at the Phil Hay Show, if you want to say hello to us, and subscribe to The Athletic if you're not there yet. Theathletic.com/LeedsPod for 33% off the price of a full subscription. And we'll return next week with a victory in the bank.
The Phil Hay Show.